So we've been checking out a true crime podcast we think you'll really like. It's called Scorned Love Kills.
Yeah, this one grabbed me right away. It's about relationships that go completely off the rails, where love, obsession, and betrayal end in some pretty shocking crimes.
And what stands out is the way they tell the stories. You hear actual audio from ID's TV show mixed with reporters, investigators, even psychologists who were close to the cases. It gives the episodes this really immersive, almost documentary feel.
And the cases are wild, like the South Carolina guy whose gambling and affairs spun into violence, or the LA deputies whose open marriage ended in a murder that took almost a decade to solve.
It's dramatic, but also really well done.
So if you're looking for your next binge, Scorned Love Kills is definitely worth it.
And you can listen to it now wherever you get your podcasts.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
This episode does include discussions of very real, troubling topics, including mentions of child abuse and the realities of the AIDS epidemic.
My name is Tony, and I was 13 years old when I was diagnosed with AIDS. One day, I asked my biological mother if she would go get me tape, soundtrack tape. She said if I was good with a job she wanted me to do, that she would get it for me. I didn't know what she wanted me to do was entertain a man that she was getting paid for. I was about 7 or 8 years old. I was bought for an hour at a time, sometimes two, sometimes for a night. And what I did depended upon what that person wanted, and they paid for it. And they found out that I had syphilis, and I was malnourished and underweight. When they'd done x-rays, they'd found out that I'd had at different times the total of 54 broken bones that had healed by themselves.
By the time Anthony Godby Johnson was just 14 years old, many people believed that his incredible life story needed to be told. Remarkably insightful and optimistic, despite his horrific upbringing, Anthony longed to share his unique perspective with the world and inspire others with his triumph over unimaginable adversity. Unfortunately, even as Anthony's life was moving forward in a positive direction with seemingly limitless possibilities ahead of him, an unseen threat was quietly growing stronger, attacking his young body. It was a relentless force, one that medical science struggled to defeat, leaving Anthony's future uncertain. With time slipping away, the question remained, would he have the chance to share his story with the world? You see, even though Anthony had been rescued from the horrors that had marked the first 11 years of his childhood, the repercussions of such brutality lingered. A devastating AIDS diagnosis brought all of the young boy's plans and dreams of his future into question, a defeat heartbreaking enough to crumble anyone. But Anthony wasn't ready to give up. He refused to be silenced. With help from the Make-A-Wish Foundation, who gave him a computer to use to write his life story, Anthony shared the secrets of his past in his memoir, A Rock and a Hard Place, One Boy's Triumphant Story. Defying all odds, Anthony's memoir was published by Crown Publishers in 1993, when Anthony was only 15 years old.
So right off the bat, that's pretty incredible. I mean, he's 15 years old. He's a published author. That's crazy.
Right. It's almost unheard of. Now, not only that, but the memoir Anthony wrote was praised and endorsed by respected figures, including doctors, acclaimed authors, and even Fred Rogers himself.
Mr. Rogers.
Yes.
Oh.
Dr. Bernie Siegel, author of the book Love, Medicine, and Miracles, described Anthony's memoir as a book about more than just surviving. It is a book about life and living, written with wisdom that can come only from experiencing adversity and afflictions. Tony Johnson has a spirit that transcends physical illness. And also, Kirkus Reviews, a respected source on book reviews and literacy criticism, praised the memoir as a virtuous, unflinching, and unsentimental account of one boy's courage amid some of the world's worst cruelties. Two of Anthony's literacy heroes, Paul Manette and Armistead Maupin, provided blurbs for his memoir. Fred Rogers, better known as Mr. Rogers, even wrote an afterword for the book. Through articles, lively discussions, and even a television documentary that featured Anthony, the teenager's story of abuse, rescue, courage, and resilience caught the world's attention, bringing awareness to two important issues: the devastating impact of AIDS and child abuse.
Wow, so this memoir really took the world by storm.
Yeah, it did.
Looking at the big picture, though, this is huge. You have a child who's still a minor. He goes public to essentially relive his past of a life that I'm assuming is riddled with trauma of child abuse and the pain of now finding out that you basically have a death sentence, you know, being a young child who has AIDS.
And it makes you wonder, how could a child who recently had gone through so much be so willing to talk about it all and lay it all out on the table? Not to mention in a very well-written way, as a lot of people have described. And it wasn't very long that people started to question things. So by the end of 1993, it would become clear that not everyone was equally as captivated by Anthony's story. Questions stirred doubt that would eventually divert all the attention in a different direction, as investigations into Anthony's life revealed compelling layers hidden just beneath the surface. People who were once inspired by Anthony's tale of bravery, resilience, and love started to wonder if there might be more to this child who many people had spoken to, yet few had seen in person. Hey, Crime Sound listeners. So today we will be looking through the layers of controversy surrounding Anthony Godby Johnson, often referred to as Tony, as we explore the mystery of a young teenager whose success story has transformed into a shadowy mystery. It's crazy. Decades after Anthony's memoir was published, questions linger around the whole controversy. We can't promise to answer all of them, but we'll do our best to untangle the web of various perspectives, arguments, inconsistencies, and bits of evidence as we try to piece together the truth behind the legend.
And before we dig too deep into it, though, we must warn you that though it has been argued that the victim in this case didn't actually go through the horrific abuse that initially brought attention to this story, this episode does include discussions of very real, troubling topics, including mentions of child abuse and the realities of the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah, if these topics are sensitive for you, you may want to skip this episode and tune in next week instead. So for now, let's turn back to the mystery of Anthony Godby Johnson and his adoptive mother, Vicky Johnson, the woman who is said to have rescued him, with some speculating that she may be even more closely tied to the young boy than she'd ever admit. I'm Ashley.
And I'm Ricky.
And this is Crime Salad. Anthony's memoir, A Rock and a Hard Place, One Boy's Triumphant Story, lays the groundwork for this confusing mystery with an introduction to his early years right on the back cover of this book. This description reads, Anthony Godby Johnson was born in 1977. Until he was 11 years old, this blonde, sunny, bright youngster in a New York City program for gifted children was subjected to continuous physical and sexual abuse by parents who looked terrifyingly normal. They beat him irregularly, withheld food, refused to let him have a bed to sleep in, a coat to wear, or a toothbrush, They invited their friends to use him sexually, but no one knew Tony's family secrets. At last, at age 11, in suicidal despair, he called a national hotline and found his rescuers.
Well, I can definitely see why this book would be so popular. I mean, being 15 and already had gone through that much stuff, I mean, it's quite the story.
Yeah, if you were to find this book at a bookstore or at the library and you pick it up and read the back cover and read this, you would want to know more of the story. You would want to read this book.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, we won't go too far into the disturbing details about the abuse the boy suffered through, but it's safe to say that the back cover of Anthony's memoir is just a glimpse of the nightmare memories Anthony shared about his childhood. A true horror story until the day that Anthony called the suicide hotline, a decision that would change his life forever. The man on the other end of the suicide hotline dispatched a social worker to follow up on Anthony's cry for help, Vicky Johnson. Vicky acted fast, saving Anthony from a life of abuse and neglect as if he was her very own child.
Okay, so now we have a hero who basically takes Anthony under her wing.
Yeah, Vicky Johnson, who eventually adopts him. Now, the man who answered Anthony's call and brought the two together felt such a strong connection to the young boy that he actually traveled to New York to meet him. While he was there, love brought the three of them closer together. The type of romance story that seems too miraculous to ever come true. The hero from the hotline married Vicky, and the couple adopted Anthony. Seeking safety, the happy little family moved to a Midwestern town where the adults who had tormented Anthony throughout his childhood, including his police officer father and his father's friends in law enforcement, could no longer harm him.
Wow, I mean, what a made-for-TV moment. It's not even just a rescue anymore. It's a romance story. I mean, it's almost too perfect.
Now, unfortunately, there were lingering effects of the abuse Anthony endured that couldn't be escaped through any amount of distance. By that time, Anthony had contracted syphilis while in the care of his abusive parents. It was left untreated and worsened to such an extent that it caused permanent damage to his lungs, leading to bouts of pneumonia that required lung draining. Among other ailments, Anthony also suffered through a stroke that left him temporarily paralyzed and in a coma. But the biggest blow of all came at a time when Anthony should have been celebrating having graduated high school at just 14 years old with the help of private tutors. Instead, the teenager was faced with the daunting shadow of a looming death after he tested positive for AIDS. AIDS was, at the time of Anthony's diagnosis, and still is, a fatal, incurable disease that develops as the most severe stage of an HIV infection. During the early years of the HIV epidemic, there were no treatments available for HIV, leaving those who had the virus with little hope of surviving long with it. By the time the virus reached that severe stage when a patient was diagnosed with AIDS, the prognosis was even more grim. People diagnosed with AIDS typically only had about 1 to 2 years left before the disease killed them. Nowadays, the prognosis for those who receive an AIDS diagnosis has improved, though not nearly enough, with the CDC stating that those with AIDS typically live for about 3 years after diagnosis. Despite this, according to those who got to know Anthony, remained positive, friendly, and determined to make whatever short time he had left on this earth as meaningful as he could manage. Encouraged and supported by his adoptive parents, Anthony wrote his memoir and made strong connections during this process. One of the closest bonds Anthony formed, although through correspondence and phone calls, was Jack Godbey, a gay Black AIDS counselor from Arkansas who the teenager came to view as a father figure. They even grew a relationship so close that Anthony would call him dad.
But he never met him in person. Wow. So is this where the Godbey came in Anthony's name? Anthony Godbey Johnson?
Yeah, and it's believed that he honored this relationship by incorporating Godbey into his name. And Anthony was inspired by others as well, great literary figures who came before him, particularly those who used their writing to explore the unfathomably challenging struggles he was facing as a young teenager at a time when HIV and AIDS were even more stigmatized than they are today. Vicky encouraged Anthony to reach out to some of his heroes, advice which Anthony took to heart, writing letters to notable creatives. A few even wrote to him back, including authors that would go on to provide blurbs for his memoir. Due to Anthony's fragile physical health and Vicky's fear that her son's abusers might target the family if they let themselves physically exposed to the outside world, most of the relationships Anthony formed were through phone calls and letters and long-distance correspondence. Aside from Vicky and her husband, no one, not even those in Anthony's inner circle of confidants, were given the chance to meet Anthony in person. However, that didn't stop many people from forming incredibly strong bonds with him. Armistead Maupin, an American author most famous for his book series Tales of the City, is one of the authors who struck up a correspondence with Anthony that went well beyond providing a blurb for his memoir after the boy reached out to him. When discussing his friendship with Anthony in a later interview, Armistead explained that he was especially sympathetic to Anthony's story, considering his partner had already been diagnosed with HIV at the time, and his best friend was on the verge of dying. In the 90s, homophobia was a widespread problem that wasn't challenged in the same way it is nowadays. So Armistead was surprised by how accepting and gay-friendly Anthony was, even though the teenage boy was straight. The two had long phone calls sharing support and friendship, and they formed a strengthening connection. However, somewhat ironically, Armistead would go on to be one of the loudest voices raising doubt about Anthony's very existence. The nagging questions started for Armistead when his partner at the time, Terry Anderson, had a short phone conversation with Vicky about 6 months after Armistead and Anthony's friendship began. After getting off the call, Armistead recalls Terry turning to him and saying, "Don't you think there's a very strange similarity in their voices?" And Armistead didn't have to ask Terry to explain. He knew exactly what his partner was talking about, though he hadn't thought to dig deep into this line of questioning before. He had already accidentally addressed Vicky as Tony during one of their calls due to the similarities of their voices. Vicky had quickly corrected him, sharing that her son hated being mistaken for his mom, effectively shooing away any doubts as Armistead remembered the struggles and the shame he experienced as a teenage boy and sympathized with Anthony.
This whole thing kind of reminds me of catfishing, like Catfish. They had the movie, the documentary, and then the MTV TV show. But it's a lot like that. These were relationships that put a lot of effort and thought into, right?
These people, even though they are popular authors, they're still vulnerable in a sense because they're, you know, experiencing these things and they're looking for connections with these similarities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And for Armistead, he had a partner who was living with HIV. So this wasn't just a story. It was real, raw, and deeply personal. It's almost a betrayal, you know, if the boy wasn't real and this was someone just catfishing or doing research for their book in a way.
Yeah. And if this was a fabricated story, I mean, it would feel very cruel, not just deceitful, but like a slap in the face to everyone who actually lived through the trauma of AIDS. It would be exploiting the pain of a community that was already marginalized, stigmatized, and fighting to stay alive and be believed. But there was something about Terry boldly pointing out the obvious, uncomfortable fact, bringing the odd coincidence to his attention that sparked an inquisitive fire in Armistead. So, with that being said, this time, he wasn't willing to let go. The writer had been hooked, and he was finally ready to dig deep into this real-life mystery. Okay, hear me out. This summer, forget about chasing some kind of summer bod. What we're chasing instead? a savings bod. You know, trimming down those wild phone bills and bulking up our wallets. And Mint Mobile is making it way too easy. I made the switch to Mint Mobile, and I've got to say, I was shocked at how smooth it was. Same phone, same number, same contacts, just way less money. I'm paying just $15 a month. That's premium wireless service for a fraction of what I used to pay. And get this, I'm still getting high-speed data, unlimited talk and text, and it all runs on the nation's largest 5G network. So yeah, I'm not sweating overpriced bills anymore. And honestly, why should any of us? This year, skip breaking a sweat and breaking the bank. Get your summer savings and shop premium wireless plans at mintmobile.com/crimesalad. That's mintmobile.com/crimesalad. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month 5 gigabyte plan required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customer offer for first 3 months only, then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details. You know what's actually underrated? Getting paid back immediately. That's why we use Cash App. It's fast, it's easy, and honestly, kind of fun. I signed up in under 5 minutes, and now it's just second nature. Whether I'm splitting dinner with a friend or sending money to my sister for that group gift she insisted on organizing, Cash App just makes it smooth. And I swear, it's the only app where paying someone doesn't feel like a chore. You can add little notes, stamps, even custom backgrounds when you send money. So it's not just functional, it's kind of fun. And listen, if you're somehow still not on Cash App, now's the time to fix that. Seriously, just download Cash App, use our exclusive code CRIMESALAD, and send $5 to a friend within 14 days. When you do, you get $10 back straight into your account. No strings, just quick cash. For a limited time only, new Cash App users can use our exclusive code to earn some additional cash. For real, there's no catch. Just download Cash App and sign up. Use our exclusive referral code CRIMESALAD in your profile, send $5 to a friend within 14 days, and you'll get $10 dropped right into your account. Terms apply. That's money. That's Cash App. So we've been checking out a true crime podcast we think you'll really like. It's called Scorned Love Kills.
Yeah, this one grabbed me right away. It's about relationships that go completely off the rails, where love, obsession, and betrayal end in some pretty shocking crimes.
And what stands out is the way they tell the stories. You hear actual audio from ID's TV show mixed with reporters, investigators, even psychologists who were close to the cases. It gives the episodes this really immersive, almost documentary feel.
And the cases are wild, like the South Carolina guy whose gambling and affairs spun into violence. Or the LA deputies whose open marriage ended in a murder that took almost a decade to solve.
It's dramatic, but also really well done.
So if you're looking for your next binge, Scorned Love Kills is definitely worth it.
And you can listen to it now wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered, like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches, but there aren't, right?
Right, because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup, and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
So we've been checking out a true crime podcast we think you'll really like. It's called Scorned Love Kills.
Yeah, this one grabbed me right away. It's about relationships that go completely off the rails, where love, obsession, and betrayal end in some pretty shocking crimes.
And what stands out is the way they tell the stories. You hear actual audio from ID's TV show mixed with reporters, investigators, even psychologists who were close to the cases. It gives the episodes this really immersive, almost documentary feel.
And the cases are wild, like the South Carolina guy whose gambling and affairs spun into violence. Or the LA deputies whose open marriage ended in a murder that took almost a decade to solve.
It's dramatic, but also really well done.
So if you're looking for your next binge, Scorned Love Kills is definitely worth it.
And you can listen to it now wherever you get your podcasts. So while researching this case, we got a chance to hear the same voice that stirred up so many questions back in the 90s. An unexpected surprise found in a short documentary about Anthony's story called Toby Fraginals. This documentary, which was directed by Ben Young and released in 2019, includes clips from another older documentary released by ABC in 1997 called About Us, The Dignity of Children, which was hosted by Oprah Winfrey. The ABC special covered several stories of child abuse, including Anthony's, and they hired a child actor to recreate images of the memories Anthony shared, paired with Anthony's own voice playing over the scenes that unfolded on the screen.
My name is Tony, and I was 13 years old when I was diagnosed with AIDS.
So this program is about you. It's about me. It's about all of
us. Okay, after listening to it, I can already say that Anthony's voice sounds quite different than what I expected a teenage boy's voice to sound like.
Yeah, and especially considering not only the sound of his voice, but also the way he speaks and the words he chooses.
Yeah, if I hadn't been told what I was listening to or the fact that I was listening to him, I think I would just assume that this was a woman speaking. Like, not a teenage girl or anything, like an adult woman.
Now, of course, the sound of voices, word choices, and mannerisms vary regardless of age or gender. Unusual differences don't automatically mean that a person is lying. There is nothing wrong or bad about a teenage boy or even a full-grown man having more of a feminine-sounding voice. However, considering the fact that Anthony's voice is reported to sound similar to Vicky's, things start to get a little eerier.
Not to mention when you start to add up the fact that no one's met this kid. They've only spoke to him through the mail or the phone. I mean, this is the 90s, so it's not like they could just jump on some FaceTime call, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, still, if that was the only sign that something wasn't quite right with Anthony's story, we probably wouldn't be discussing the growing doubts about his existence decades after his memoir was published. The thing is, it wasn't just Anthony's speaking voice that sounded not quite right. His writing style also stood out as unusual and surprisingly advanced for his age, not at all what most would expect from a teenage boy. In their review of the memoir, Kirkus Reviews included a couple of quotes from the book, which are great examples of this. The first one reads, "While other kids were being tossed into the air, hugged and caressed and lulled to sleep by their mothers, I was being flung into corners and slapped across rooms." In the second quote, "I am not an object of shame, but a portrait of pride. I hold my head high and say my name aloud." Many people who had conversations with Anthony and or read his memoir have agreed that his writing style and his vocabulary didn't seem like that of a 14-year-old boy. So when it was discovered that Vicky Johnson didn't appear to have any social work credentials, but did have an interest in creative writing, the shady, mysterious pieces started to form a picture that made all too much sense in a gross way.
Wow.
Still, this wasn't enough to answer all the countless questions, some of which to this day have never been answered. Perhaps the most damning part of this whole thing was the fact that few people ever saw Anthony Godby Johnson in person. And it wasn't from lack of trying either. As Anthony's story spread, many people wanted to meet the incredibly gifted and insightful boy in person, including Armistead Maupin and also a rabbi from Israel, both who traveled to the Midwest only to be turned away. Every time anyone tried to meet Anthony in person, Vicky claimed that he was too sick to receive visitors. Despite this, Anthony didn't succumb to his worsening health issues. In fact, his life stretched on much longer than expected, the type of medical miracle that's nearly unfathomable. As the years passed by, Anthony was always too sick to interact with anyone face to face, but he kept on surviving all the same. Michelle Ingracia, a Newsweek reporter, also tried to meet Anthony in person, a meeting which, of course, Vicky denied due to the boy's poor health. The reporter wasn't satisfied with that excuse, so she consulted an expert in pediatric AIDS who told her that even if Anthony had drug-resistant TB, it would be safe for visitors to see Anthony as long as they went in with a mask and abided by well-defined precautions. In 1993, Michelle published an article titled "The Author Nobody Met," which explores her suspicions about Anthony's story. And in the article, Michelle quotes a passage from Anthony's book that reads, "Diseases were a means of financing sports cars for cocky physicians who thought they had the world by the short hairs by virtue of their prescription pads." This is just an example of how Anthony's writing style didn't quite fit what most people would expect from a teenager. She questions the truth about Anthony's biological parents, who were said to have been serving lengthy prison sentences due to the abuse they inflicted on their son. A case that apparently everyone in the Manhattan DA's office had forgotten, unable to recall a single case that even came close to matching the details Anthony had shared. Though unable to meet Anthony due to life-threatening health issues, the team at Newsweek was able to speak to him through a lengthy phone interview during which Michelle insisted that Anthony never coughed, wheezed, or appeared to struggle for breath.
All right, so this part is a little weird to me, because I would think that if he truly had advanced AIDS and drug-resistant TB, it's unlikely that he would even be able to speak comfortably on the phone for such long periods of time without showing any type of respiratory distress. I mean, not to mention, didn't he have his lung drained?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or fatigue or anything, right? Like, if you're sick, you're going to want to go to sleep. You're going to be weak.
And to add to that, there was more than 6 years having passed since Anthony had received that terminal AIDS diagnosis. Anthony was still alive. If any of this could have been proven to be true, then it would have been a medical miracle.
See, to me, it seems like Anthony was Vicky's cash cow. Like, she had to keep him alive. She had to keep the story going.
Mm-hmm.
She was padding her pockets, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. And suspicion towards Vicky, it continued to deepen after it was discovered that Vicky Johnson was actually Joanne Vicky Fraginals, a woman who lived in New Jersey with two adult women in a second-story apartment that was inaccessible for wheelchairs, not at all suitable for the sick teenager, which no one in the area had interacted with.
Yeah, that's suspicious.
Dr. Mark Feldman, a clinical professor of psychiatry and expert on fictitious disorder, shared his thoughts on the tangled mess in an interview with the New York Post in 2006, believing Vicky Johnson to be an extremely intelligent and creative person. He explained, "Tony Johnson tapped into people's needs for rescuing, for feeling big-hearted, and there may be other weaknesses that Vicky could discern and tap into. Some of these people are undeniably a little sadistic, misleading people, especially famous people, is very gratifying for them."
I mean, that part is pretty interesting.
Yeah. Now, in 2000, Armistead Maupin published The Night Listener, a fictional book which was heavily inspired by his investigation into the mystery surrounding Anthony and the relationship that had developed between them during the 6 years that had passed since they started communicating. By that time, Anthony had contracted TB and lost a leg and a testicle to AIDS.
Which further adds to all of this confusion, being that they lived on a second-story floor.
Yeah, yet even now, 25 years after The Night Listener was released, we've yet to get solid proof of Anthony's existence. Leslie Karsten, producer of About Us, The Dignity of Children, the documentary that featured Anthony, is the only person aside from Vicky who claims to have ever seen Anthony in person. And her account, well, we'll just say it seems not exactly reliable at best. There's also been no trace of the man who supposedly answered Anthony's call to the suicide hotline, married Vicky, and also adopted Anthony, bringing his existence into question as well.
Oh, wow.
Now, sometime after Anthony was said to have moved out of Vicky's home, Vicky Fraginals eventually got married to Mark Zeckheim, an established psychotherapist. She adopted four brothers with him in 1999. In 2004, the couple's story, already a bit shady, took on an even darker hue when Mark was accused of molesting boys in the group home he worked at. Mark was acquitted of these charges and died of a heart attack while driving in November of 2009, less than a month before he was supposed to be serving a 13-month prison sentence, pleading guilty to healthcare fraud charges earlier that year. And as for Vicky, she died on July 31st, 2010, when she was 53 years old. She never backed down from her claims that Anthony was a real boy she had rescued, grown into a man that she said was alive and well whenever she spoke of him. The end of Vicky's life has proven to be the end of updates about Anthony. As far as we know, no one has ever heard from Anthony Godby Johnson since Vicky's death, leaving the mystery to linger without a resolution, or maybe, perhaps, that unbroken silence is the most honest, absolute answer. If you're into haunted history, cryptids, alien abductions, or anything that makes the hair on your neck stand up, you have to check out the Graveyard Tales podcast. Hosted by Adam and Matt, these guys dive deep into some of the creepiest and most fascinating stories out there. We're talking shadow people, the fae, cattle mutilations, spontaneous human combustion, even the Travis Walton abduction and the multiverse theory. They take their research seriously, but what makes it stand out is how fun and easy they make it to listen. It's like hanging out with your two funniest friends who happen to love the paranormal. Whether you're new to strange phenomena or you've already got a favorite cryptid, there's something in every episode to pull you in. So head on over to graveyardpodcast.com or listen to Graveyard Tales wherever you get your podcast. You can also find them on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, or Rumble. So we've been checking out a true crime podcast we think you'll really like. It's called Scorned Love Kills.
Yeah, this one grabbed me right away. It's about relationships that go completely off the rails, where love, obsession, and betrayal end in some pretty shocking crimes.
And what stands out is the way they tell the stories. You hear actual audio from ID's TV show mixed with reporters, investigators, even psychologists who were close to the cases. It gives the episodes this really immersive, almost documentary feel.
And the cases are wild, like the South Carolina guy whose gambling and affairs spun into violence, or the LA deputies whose open marriage ended in a murder that took almost a decade to solve.
It's dramatic, but also really well done.
So if you're looking for your next binge, Scorned Love Kills is definitely worth it.
And you can listen to it now wherever you get your podcasts. Maybe Anthony Godby Johnson never existed. Maybe the heart-wrenching story of a resilient teenage boy who overcame horrific abuse and a terminal illness was, in the end, a complete fabrication crafted not only by a survivor, but by an adult woman named Joanne Vicky Fraginals. The signs are hard to ignore. The lack of public appearances, the suspiciously mature writing voice, the unverifiable prison case against his supposed parents, and the invasiveness whenever someone tried to meet him in person. Was Anthony ever a real boy? Or was he simply a character born out of imagination and sustained by the compassion of others? But still, whether Anthony was real or not, the issues that brought attention to child abuse, sexual trauma, homophobia, and the brutal realities of living with AIDS are painfully real. They continue to affect real people every single day. And maybe that's the most sobering part of it all, that someone would invent such a story using these tragedies as the foundation. But even if the boy behind the voice wasn't real, the voices of those who have truly suffered through these things absolutely are, and they deserve to be heard. Paul Manette, an author Anthony reached out and admired, is just one example of the devastation caused by the relentless spread of HIV and AIDS. As a gay rights activist, Paul was known for his poetry about homosexual relationships, which took a more somber turn in 1985, after his long-term partner, Roger Horwitz, died of AIDS. In his autobiography titled Borrowed Time, an AIDS memoir, Paul wrote about the cruel indifference shown towards those suffering from AIDS, saying, quote, "When Larry Kramer tells Mathilde Krim in interview about the closeted gay man at the National Institutes of Health who buried the AIDS data for 2 years, That's how I understand how doomed we were before we ever knew. It will be recorded that the dead in the first decade of the calamity died of our indifference, unquote. Paul Manette eventually lost his own life to AIDS complications in 1995 when he was only 49 years old. According to the CDC, the rate of HIV-related deaths started rapidly increasing in the 80s, with a peak annual death rate occurring in 1994 when it was estimated that almost 42,000 United States residents died from HIV. But far from a hopeless cause, as awareness of the issue became more widespread and research led to breakthrough treatment options, the rate of HIV deaths started decreasing rapidly through 1997. This trend has continued as the annual HIV death rate decreased in the United States from 2.6 deaths per 100,000 in 2010 to 1.3 deaths per 100,000 in 2021. Globally, since 2004, AIDS-related deaths have gone down 69%. Terry Tez Anderson, Armistead's former partner, was diagnosed with HIV in 1983. Now in his 60s, Tez is an activist, writer, and founder of Let's Kick Ass AIDS Survivor Syndrome, an organization that was established in 2013 that focuses on uplifting, advocating for, and improving the lives of long-term survivors of HIV. As stated on their website, the organization's mission is to empower those living long-term with HIV, helping them flourish through building connections, re-engaging, and mobilizing to advocate for change that focuses on and enhances their quality of life, ending isolation and envisioning a future we never imagined we'd live in. Collaborating with HIV advocates, providers, and researchers, the organization is a powerful example of the long, meaningful lives that can be enjoyed even after receiving an HIV diagnosis. Despite these promising advances, HIV is still a threat that continues to harm innocent people worldwide. It's estimated that around 630,000 people died from AIDS-related illnesses in 2023. With about one person dying from HIV every minute of 2023. In the United States, HIV ranked 13th on the list of leading causes of death among all persons aged 25 to 44 in 2021. One of the most important steps people can take towards decreasing the number of HIV-related deaths is to focus on prevention. Ways to prevent the spread of HIV includes correctly using condoms during sex, never sharing needles, syringes, or other drug injection equipment, taking PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, before engaging in activities that could lead to potential exposure to HIV, and taking PEP, post-exposure prophylaxis, after potential exposure to HIV. For those who do contract HIV, awareness is key. This can be tricky because many HIV symptoms can be mistaken for the flu. Symptoms of HIV tend to start within 2 to 4 weeks after infection and can include fever, chills, rash, night sweats, muscle aches, sore throat, fatigue, swollen lymph nodes, and mouth ulcers. In some cases, patients don't experience any initial symptoms at all. That's part of why getting tested for HIV is so important. Treatment options available for people who are HIV positive can prolong patients' lives, preserve their quality of life, and help protect their partners from contracting the virus. One study done in Switzerland in 2017 found that the life expectancy for HIV patients at age 20 went up from 11.8 years to 54.9 years with the introduction of combination antiretroviral therapy. The effectiveness of this treatment was confirmed by another study done in 2022 that looked at data from 200,000 people in Europe and North America who were HIV positive. Researchers concluded that patients who were undergoing long-term HIV treatment and had high CD4 counts had lifespans similar to the general population. The success rate of these treatments and interventions does depend on timeliness and, of course, working with medical professionals who provide this type of care. It's vital for anyone who is diagnosed with HIV or believes they may have contracted HIV to seek medical help as soon as possible to ensure the best possible prognosis. So as we wrap up this week's episode, one thing that really stands out to me, stories like this and similar stories, it can damage victims' credibility. And it feels like this story, you know, it most likely inspired so many people to move forward if they had AIDS or if they were struggling with past trauma. But then to find out that this was possibly a fabricated story, it's just so wrong.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it makes you wonder what her real intentions were. Were her intentions to help people, or were they to sell books and get attention?
Yeah, make some money and be famous.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to say. But I guess you could say that it worked, although I feel like it wouldn't be that hard to figure out if this is real or not. I mean, there's so many things. One, he was treated for HIV, so like, where are the medical records? Does he have a birth certificate?
There was really nothing like that. No birth certificate or adoption records for Anthony Godby Johnson were ever found. Additionally, no legal documentation supports the claims that his biological parents were ever tried or convicted for abuse as described in his memoir.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the big thing for me, because this is the 90s. This isn't, you know, in the 40s or something where records would be lost. Like, there's got to be something. I mean, even Joe Dirt's parents popped up, you know?
Wow, yeah. Maybe that was based on this. Who knows? Now, even the picture of Anthony Godby Johnson that so many people seen, this was actually proven to be someone else.
Wait, what?
Yeah, the photograph that was circulating as Anthony was later identified as a childhood photo of a former student taught by Vicky Johnson. And this person had no clue his image was being used in this context.
Wow, if I were that person, I would sue for some money, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, that aside, that has to show that this isn't real. Like, how are you going to spoof the picture?
Yeah. So as we wrap up today's episode, it's important to remember that experts widely agree that cases of children falsely claiming abuse are rare, making up as little as 2% of reported cases of child abuse. So we hope that our audience will remember not to let stories like the case of Anthony Godby Johnson doubt victims who are brave enough to come forward, regardless of your views on this particular case. That being said, we'd love to hear your perspective on Anthony's story. Do you think Anthony Godby Johnson was a real teenage boy who was unfairly discredited? Or do you believe that Vicky Johnson, or maybe even someone else entirely, made this whole thing up? If so, what do you think might have motivated the person behind the mask to concoct such an elaborate story?
Initially, I thought it was all for money, but I know a lot of things with these catfish things, too. It's like, she was very intelligent. And, you know, I think she just kind of got lost in it.
Yeah.
Dug a really deep hole and, you know, probably also to push some book sales and stuff. But I don't know.
I mean, even to do interviews and pretend to be Anthony is just wild.
Yeah.
We would also really appreciate it if you could also take a moment to share today's episode on social media as we continue to work to grow our channel. As always, we're so grateful for our Crime Salad Patreon and Apple subscribers. Your support means the world to us, and it helps us play our part in sharing the insights and answers we gather while researching these cases. Thank you for tuning in. We're grateful for this chance to dive into these important topics as we do our best to lend our voice to those who have been unfairly silenced. Stay safe, take care of yourselves, and we'll catch you next week for another deep dive into the stories that need to be told.